And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, saying, "Come and see."
Noise of Thunder Radio with Christian J. Pinto.
Okay, praise the Lord, you guys, and welcome. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we are going to talk about the upcoming anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19th, 1775. A very, very famous day, the day that many believe was really the official beginning of the American Revolution. Although a lot of times people will trace the revolution to 1776 when the Declaration of Independence was made, but it was actually a year earlier that the openly armed conflict began against the British and against King George III when they came to confiscate arms at Lexington originally. Then what happened was you had the militiamen, the Minutemen who were there. They were not willing to surrender their arms, so there was a gun battle that took place. Then the Redcoats moved. They retreated and moved on, and then they were followed by the Patriots until Concord Bridge, where the battle continued at Concord as well. So both of those battles happened on April the 19th, 1775, and they're very, very famous among those, especially those who are defenders of the Second Amendment. And it's what I think a lot of people in different parts of the world, in some of these other countries, whether in Canada or Australia, perhaps New Zealand, some of these other countries that are English-speaking countries, they wonder why America is so determined where the Second Amendment, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, is concerned. And it has to do with our history. I'm not sure that any of these other countries have, in particular, a foundational history as we have here in the United States, where our country literally, well, the United States of America literally, was separated from England. These United States were separated from England based on a long train of abuses, as the Declaration of Independence says. But the line in the sand, the last straw, as it were, where our forefathers said, "Thus far and no farther, that's it, enough is enough," was when they came to confiscate arms at Lexington. That's what began. That's where the shot heard round the world was fired. Now, in honor of the anniversary of Lexington and Concord, let's go over we're going to talk about this from a historic perspective and also from a biblical perspective. Let's talk a little bit about the history. I'm going to give you a couple of quotes here from history, because these issues continue to be discussed and debated. And as I've said before, you have those in the media, mainstream media right now, one of their favorite arguments that I've heard over and over and over again is the claim that they're making that prior to 2008, when the Supreme Court gave the ruling in what is called the Heller case, that supposedly nobody ever thought that there was an individual right to keep and bear arms, that that's something that was invented in 2008. Now, guys, we got to recognize that that is a false version of history. A few weeks ago, David Hogg, who's the famous anti-gun activist, tweeted. But he posted online, he said, quote, "You have no right to a gun. You are not a militia. When you're talking about your Second Amendment rights, you're talking about a state's right to have what is today the National Guard. This is what he says. He says, quote, "The modern interpretation of Second Amendment is a ridiculous fraud pushed for decades by the gun lobby." Now, that's what David Hogg says. Now, he's saying that because of this argument that has emerged that prior to 2008, nobody ever believed in an individual's right to keep and bear arms. Now, that is a false narrative. And I actually posted online. Some of you would have seen this on our Facebook page. But the reality is the very first challenge historically in our courts to the Second Amendment at any level was in 1836 with a case called Nunn versus Georgia. Nunn versus Georgia. And it shows the original understanding. But this is the first time you had the Georgia Supreme Court gave a ruling on this and said, quote, "The right of the whole people, old and young, men, women, and boys, and not militia only, to keep and bear arms of every description, not merely as are used by the militia, shall not be infringed, curtailed, or broken in upon in the smallest degree." And then it goes on from there. Okay? So notice the Georgia Supreme Court points out, rightly so, that the right to keep and bear arms is not to the militia. The right is to the people. It's the right of the people, not the militia. And notice the distinction that they make. They say it's the right of the whole people and not militia only to keep and bear arms. So you can't say, well, it's only the militia can keep and bear arms. No, that's not what the amendment says. The amendment acknowledges the right of the people, and then the militia is chosen out from the people. Now, you have different views of this historically. For example, I'm going to give you a few quotes here. One, you have George Mason, who said, quote, "I ask, sir, what is the militia?" He says, "It is the whole people." So that's one view. And really, George Mason was talking about the way that the condition that the country was in during the time of the Revolution. It was necessary that the whole people be joined together and take up arms and fight against England, because England was the most powerful country in the world at that time, and the Redcoats were the best soldiers on the earth at that time. And so the whole people were necessary to stand against them. However, there are times when you separate, you find other quotes where it talks about the militia being men 18 to 45 years old. Really, what that's referring to is men who were then required. Because you have to think about it. When they're going to call the people to war, which is a practice that goes back to ancient times, it's the way it was done in the Old Testament. Okay, you think about like the story of Gideon. When the men are called out to war, they don't have 6 weeks of basic training to teach the men how to fight. When the men show up, they have to know how to fight when they get there. That was the idea. Same thing with the Benjamite War, when you read about at the end of the book of Judges, when they go to war against the tribe of Benjamin, all the people show up. It says they all rose up as one man. They were all determined. They had to hold Benjamin accountable for the crime that they had committed. But they don't go through 6 weeks or several months of basic training or something. The men who show up have to be armed when they arrive, and they have to know how to use their arms when they arrive. There's a quote from Granville Sharp where he talks about this in English tradition, English law, that every Englishman not only had to be armed, but had to be expert in arms. That went all the way back to King Alfred the Great. That was a statute, a law, an expectation that all the men had to be armed. Here's another quote. This one from George Washington. Washington said, quote, "The militia of this country must be considered as the palladium of our security and the first effectual resort in case of hostility." Now, remember, the militia are really calling up the people to war. That's what it is. When if the country's invaded, you call the people to war. And the people who are going to show up, because you have to think about it now. You're not going to ask 5-year-old little kids to show up for war. And you're not going to ask 80-year-old men to show up for war, right? So you have to have a boundary. You have to be able to say, okay, these people. So that's why you find other quotes historically where they would say the militia is all men 18 to 45. What that means is if you're 18 to 45 years old, you are required to take up arms and go and report to whoever the authorities are so that you can be organized into a fighting force to repel the enemy. That's a requirement. Now, from ancient times, if you did not show up for war, that was considered a capital offense. We even read about this in the book of Judges. If you read about the Benjamite War, at one point, after the war is fought, they ask the question, which of the towns in Israel did not send men to the battle? And that town, they went to that town and they slaughtered all the men of that town as a judgment against them for refusing to go to war. In the book of Judges, and when you have the Song of Deborah, after they fight Sisera and defeat him and the Canaanite armies, in the Song of Deborah, Deborah says, "Cursed be Meraz, says the angel of the Lord. Curse bitterly the inhabitants thereof, because they would not come to help the Lord against the mighty." In other words, the people of ancient Meraz, a city in ancient Israel, refused to go to war. And so here you have the angel of the Lord pronouncing a curse upon them. So from ancient times, the standard was when it is time for war, the young men, the men who are considered within a certain age group where they ought to go to war, must go to war. It's not an option. You have to go to war. It's time for war. Remember when Moses in the Old Testament, when he confronts Gad and Reuben, because they had gotten comfortable on the other side of the Jordan, and there was speculation that they were not going to be willing to go to war. And Moses confronts them and says, "Will you sit here while your brethren go to war?" And it's very, very clear that there was this expectation and that Moses was frowning on the idea that they would not go to war. And of course, Gad and Reuben, they say, "Well, of course, Moses, we will go armed to war, as you've said." And Moses says, "Okay, if you do this, then you'll be in the clear. But if not, then know this, that you have sinned against the Lord, and be sure your sin will find you out." That's where that verse of scripture comes from. It's also worth considering that the children of Israel, why could they not enter into the promised land, the land of Canaan, because of their unbelief? What was their unbelief? They were fearful that they would not be able to defeat the Canaanite armies. They were fearful that God would not grant them victory. So they were complaining that, well, what if we get killed and what's going to happen to our children? Our children will be a prey. They're going to be preyed upon by these heathen. And so they wanted to turn back and go back to Egypt because they were refusing to go to war. Now, I'm pointing all these things out because the mentality that we have, the post-World War II mentality, is largely an effeminized view of war that in no small way is influenced by the communists and the socialists and these anti-war activists that showed up after World War II. That's where this modern mentality of, well, it's, you know, we shouldn't have to go to war if we don't want to. And this guy, that whole mentality is not really a biblical mentality. And it's very contrary to the mentality of our ancestors going back more than 1,000 years. So the right to bear arms is for all the people, so that all the people have a right to keep and bear arms, to defend themselves, and to be in the regular usage of arms, so that if a militia is called up from among the people, the militia can be called into action. That is the thought process of the Second Amendment, the wording of the Second Amendment. That's the thought process. But the right is to the people. The right is not to the militia. And that's very important for us to understand, because that's what the amendment says. It says the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. It's not the right of the militia. And that distinction was made from the very, very earliest records that we have. Now, let me give a few more quotes. There's a great quote from Andrew Jackson. And Jackson is really the context, as he's talking about having a standing army, because that was something that the United States began to do, even though it was contrary to the original thinking of our forefathers. They believed that a standing army was the bane of liberty, because it would be oppressive and it required more taxes and it was expensive to maintain, and all these problems came about as a result. So they didn't like the idea of a standing army. They wanted the common people armed so they knew how to use arms, so that if a war was necessary, you could call up the militia, which would be men of a certain age. You would call them to war, okay? And they were required to turn out and go to war. And so Andrew Jackson is talking about this, and he's talking about how he believes that as long as we have good government in our country, then our standing army will serve the needs of the people. But he says, and this is the quote I'm going to give, quote, "But the bulwark of our defense is the national militia, a million of armed freemen possessed of the means of war." Now, clearly, when he says a million of armed freemen, he's not talking about a government-controlled force. He's talking about the people. Because the militia is understood in two ways. One, it's those who are required to go to war, but it's also, as George Mason says at one point, what is the militia? It is the whole people. The national militia is the whole nation of free men armed. And so John Adams, at one point, he says this. He says, quote, "Whenever the militia comes to an end or is despised or neglected, I shall consider this union dissolved and the liberties of North America lost forever." That's what Adams said. Very, very interesting. And of course, he was talking about, if you read the whole context there, that's the response of John Adams in a letter to a guy named William Sumner, which I highly recommend if you really want to get lots of great details on the history of the Second Amendment and the mentality of our forefathers on that issue. Read the letter of William H. Sumner, where he's writing to John Adams, and then John Adams' reply. It's all very, very interesting. We don't have time to go over it all, but it's very interesting. And Adams argued that from the earliest days of the colonies, the Puritans and the Pilgrims maintained armed militia, the people armed. And it was a requirement in early America. If you were a man, a Christian man, you were required to be armed by law. Why? Well, if you study the Puritans, and we talk about this in part in our film, The True Christian History of America, the Puritans believed Psalm 149 required that all the saints should have a two-edged sword in their hands. Let me read Psalm 149, beginning at verse 5. It says, "Let the saints be joyful in glory. Let them sing aloud upon their beds. Let the high praises of God be in their mouth and a two-edged sword in their hand, to execute vengeance upon the heathen and punishments upon the people, to bind their kings with chains and their nobles with fetters of iron, to execute upon them the judgment written. This honor have all his saints. Praise ye the Lord." Now that is why I believe they argued, if you just go read the collective evidence, that is why they argued that all men, and of course they would include women, should have the right to bear arms. Because all the saints, this honor have all his saints. In the New Testament, all who are believers in Christ are called saints. And if necessary, the saints must stand their ground, must fight against the heathen, just like King Alfred the Great did. If tyrants arise who are in rebellion to God, they must be able to bind those kings with chains and the nobles with fetters of iron. And to execute against them the judgment written. Written where? In the Word of God. In the pages of Holy Scripture. This is what our ancestors believed. This is why in a Christian society, all the men had the right to keep and bear arms. It was because government was to operate as the minister of God, as Romans 13 says, and that the check on the powers of government to make sure that government did not fall into idolatry and rebellion against God, the check on government was an armed population of people. That was the check. That's what they believed. That goes all the way back to Magna Carta with Article 61, which is where right of revolution was first signed into English law. Unfortunately, many of these lessons have been lost in the post-World War II generation because of how they have changed our history books. We've tried to put back some of those pages of history through the documentaries we've made, and especially our last one, The True Christian History of America. All right, let's go to our commercial break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about the significance of April 19th. Why? Because that date, yes, it represents the battles of Lexington and Concord, but in modern times, it also has another significance. We'll talk about that when we come back right after this.
Adullam Films presents a stunning new documentary, The True Christian History of America, exploring the Bible-based Christian origins of the early American view of freedom, tracing the principles of liberty back to England and the Great Reformation. For many years, our schools have taught that the founding of our republic was from the deists or the Enlightenment in France. But is that truly the case? Did the Enlightenment first declare no taxation without representation or trial by jury? Were they the champions of freedom of speech or of the press or the right to bear arms? And why did Samuel Adams declare that the reign of political Protestantism would commence just before signing the Declaration of Independence? Filmed on location in both the United States and Europe, The True Christian History of America is now available at adullamfilms.com. That's adullamfilms.com. Now available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Adullam Films presents an exciting new documentary, Bridge to Babylon, part three in an award-winning series on the untold history of the Bible. Dr. Jack Moorman calls it a masterful presentation of what is the single most important issue facing Christians today, the defense of the Bible as the Word of God. Why was the Bible changed in 1881? Why have so many churches abandoned biblical inerrancy? And what direction are scholars taking the Scriptures today? Learn the truth in Bridge to Babylon, the sequel to A Lamp in the Dark and Tares Among the Wheat. Bridge to Babylon is now available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Noise of Thunder Radio.
Okay, we are back. Praise the Lord, you guys. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Thanks for staying with the show today. Today, we are talking about the upcoming anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord on April 19th. Just right here, by the time you're listening to this show, it may be the 19th. Now, part of the reason why I wanted to do this show is not only because of the anniversary, but because there were some peculiar things going on in the news. First, it was reported that President Trump launched his 2024 presidential campaign in Waco, Texas. That's where he chose to have his first official rally as a candidate, presidential candidate for 2024. And he holds the rally in Waco, Texas. Well, there are all these comments that are being made about the significance of it, that it of course, whenever anybody hears the name Waco, you immediately think about the Waco massacre, the siege at Waco, what happened there with David Koresh, the Branch Davidians, the ATF, all of it. And there have been a number of documentaries that have been made. Well, at the same time that this happens, right around the same time, Netflix releases a documentary on Waco. And I'm sitting here watching this going, huh, that's kind of strange. Why do they suddenly decide to produce a new documentary on Waco? I mean, there have been so many different documentaries and videos and things like that on it. Why would they choose to do this now? And then we've got President Trump launching his presidential campaign from Waco. What's going on? What's happening? Well, then I realized something I just never realized before, that Waco, that the actual siege at Waco, even though it went on in total for, I think, about 51 days, that the whole thing was brought to a fiery conclusion where the whole Branch Davidian compound explodes in flames and all these people are killed. That whole event happened on April 19th. It actually happened on the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord. Okay. Then what happens is this Netflix documentary, I decided to watch this Netflix documentary because what the globalists have been doing, they've been signaling things. Like they had all these documentaries on pandemics that it just so happens they were producing in the months and years right before 2020, when COVID was announced and the plandemic was, became a global reality. So we've seen them do that. We saw how they developed this other film called White Noise, where they have a train that is derailed and all these chemicals get into the environment and it leads to catastrophe and the people have to be quarantined to avoid the chemical poisoning and this kind of thing. And then we have these trains being derailed in different parts of the country. And there's been a number of them. And I'm sitting here wondering, have we ever had this many trains suddenly derail that just happen to have these harmful chemicals on them? Is this a coincidence? Or are there globalist planners behind the scenes who are engineering these things? Many people believe that the globalists are controlling Hollywood and they are manipulating these events. Now, can we prove that? We don't have any way of proving it. Well, at least we don't have any way of proving it beyond a reasonable doubt. I'm not sure how you would do that, but the connections are certainly there. The connections are certainly there. That the intelligence community is interwoven with Hollywood and a lot of these other industries. In fact, this whole Bud Light controversy that's gone on, where they had this transgender guy become the new spokesman for Bud Light, and that's turned into a huge backlash. Now it's been revealed that the current CEO for Bud Light is a former CIA agent. And when I saw that, it reminded me of Norman Dodd's testimony, who was with the Reese Committee, and he talked about how OSS agents, Office of Strategic Services, that became the CIA, that these spies, OSS agents, were involved with the tax-exempt foundations, Rockefeller, Ford, Carnegie. And probably that whole system has continued because these tax-exempt foundations, the billionaires, the people with all the money, they are very clearly manipulating this whole globalist plan. And when you see American Jesuits, once we release it, we're still just a couple of months away, and we're planning to next month in May to actually allow a pre-sale for those who want to pre-order a copy of the DVD once it's completed. We're planning on that, but we want to get a little bit farther along in the editing before we do that. Nevertheless, we're going to show you how the spies that work for the CIA are actually trained through Georgetown University. We're going to show you the documentation for that. Georgetown, the headquarters of the Jesuits. Anyway, all right. So let me play you. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to play the audio from this Netflix documentary so you can hear this journalist, a female journalist who's being interviewed. And she was actually at Waco back when it happened. And she talks about how, and I had never heard this before. You watch this on the Netflix documentary. Timothy McVeigh apparently showed up at Waco during the 51-day period that there was this whole struggle between David Koresh and the federal agents. Then the whole thing goes up in flames on April 19th. And then years later, she points out that the Oklahoma City bombing also happened on April 19th. And she believed that it was somehow or other Timothy McVeigh lashing out because of what happened at Waco. Okay, but let me play you the audio and then we'll talk about it. Here it is. Listen.
More than 90 people, including four law enforcement officers and 22 children, died as a direct result or indirect result of federal government action.
Everyone who touched the ball fumbled it.
Several years after when the Oklahoma City bombing happened, somebody on the radio mentioned something about the date. It was April 19th. And I had to stop the car and throw up in a ditch because there is a direct line from Waco to Oklahoma City. Bob Ricks, the FBI's main spokesman in Waco, was also the FBI's special agent in charge of the Oklahoma City office. You know, Tim McVeigh feeling compelled to take revenge because of what happened in Waco. I hate that day for many reasons.
After that day, it's hard to see that kind of stuff and say, wow, how could this happen? How could a omnipotent God let something like this happen? And you have to step back and say, well, it's not God that let it happen. It's man made it happen.
Okay, so notice the repeated references there to, quote, that day. That day, and how the female journalist says, I hate that day for many reasons, she says. For many reasons. What would the many reasons be that she hates April 19th? Is it possible that one of the reasons could be because April 19th is the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord, and that it symbolizes the Second Amendment, the right to keep and bear arms, and the refusal of our ancestors to give up that right? And you have this whole mentality that exists in our country, especially in the media and among these liberal elites, the idea that the right itself should not exist. Even though they'll say, oh, we're not trying to take away the right to bear arms. No, we don't. They'll say that. But as we've shown before, once you see the Jesuit involvement and America Magazine and their headline, Repeal the Second Amendment, there's no question the ultimate destination that they have in view for all of this anti-gun rhetoric that goes on. It's ultimately to get rid of the Second Amendment. And that is their destination point, I believe. And I believe it because they've openly said it and they've repeatedly said it. If you just go on Google and you type repeal the Second Amendment, just type that up and go read all the different articles that are published, not just America Magazine, but other resources as well, calling for a repeal or an overturning or getting rid of the right of the people to keep and bear arms. That is definitely part of this globalist movement in our country. So, is there some kind of significance? Is there something around the date? Because if you watch the Waco documentary, there's two of them that I recommend watching. There's one that was made over 20 years ago called Waco Rules of Engagement. That's where you get a lot of the details that you typically don't find elsewhere. And then there's this one, which is called Waco. What was it called? Waco American Apocalypse. American Apocalypse. Now, there is this description from one of the guys, one of the federal agents who was a sniper working for the federal government at the time, and he describes what it looked like when the whole thing happened, like in the aftermath, after the whole Branch Davidian compound burned to the ground and everything. He describes the scene. Let me just play a little bit of his audio so you can hear his description. And his description is preceded by a few other comments you'll hear from others just about the shock that everybody experiences. They watch the whole compound go up in flames, knowing that all these people were, and that many of them were children, were dying. Listen.
It's just horrible to imagine that that many people would stay inside a burning building and follow someone to their grave.
This was a tragedy that the entire country got to watch in real time.
I got up out of Sierra 2, walked that 307 yards to the burning pile of embers, and it was a rain of paper that had burned, and it had floated up into the thermals of the heat, and there were individual pages of Bibles. It was raining Bible pages into these embers, and the embers were 1.6 million rounds of rifle ammo cooking off, so it's ammo popping off everywhere you go, and skulls everywhere, and half-burned bodies. I mean, it was apocalyptic carnage. I don't know what hell looks like, but maybe that.
Okay, so now this is again from the Netflix documentary on Waco American Apocalypse, and the tone of those comments is in the direction that supposedly David Koresh and his followers all chose to commit suicide by fire, supposedly. If you watch the other documentary, Waco Rules of Engagement, it's a very different conclusion. And that's where they show that it was at least the very strong assertion of Waco Rules of Engagement is that the federal agents knew full well what they were doing when they sent these tanks in, and the tanks were equipped with tear gas, massive amounts of tear gas, and they broke through the walls with these kind of extension poles that they had, broke into the walls, pumped massive amounts of tear gas into the compound, and then set the tear gas on fire by firing machine gun rounds or possibly even flash bombs or something like that. It's kind of hard to say because they're using thermal imagery to make the argument in Waco Rules of Engagement, but there's no clear agreement. That's the problem. So again, you kind of come back to the audience where you just say, okay, what do you think logically happened? The survivors who survived from within the Davidian compound argue that no, they did not set fire to the structure, that it was done by the federal agents. Okay. And the federal agents, of course, deny that they did it. They say, no, we didn't do it. It was David Koresh. He was a madman. He's responsible. And that kind of goes back and forth. But one thing that is very peculiar, if you watch the Netflix documentary, this is the thing that really caught my attention. You watch the Netflix documentary, everything's going along. There's these negotiations that are happening back and forth with David Koresh. And then all of a sudden, when April 19th shows up, the federal agents decide, okay, today, on this day, we are going to bring this thing to an end. It all ends today, on this day, after more than 50 days of back and forth. But now, suddenly, on April 19th, they had to bring the whole thing to an end. And boom, you know, what happened happened. They start pumping the tear gas in. The whole thing catches fire. And David Koresh and his supporters who had remained in there were all destroyed, except I think one or two escaped who were able to get out of the building. Very controversial. And you have to go listen to the testimonies of the people who survived. The thing that's very interesting about the Netflix documentary is they show people who were David Koresh followers who survived. They show FBI agents, ATF agents, and journalists. So even though I know that they were biased in the direction of the federal government, nevertheless, they did take the time to get testimonies from all sides of that whole issue. And as a, you know, as simply a matter of history, documenting history, which is something that I value as a documentarian, I appreciated the fact that they gathered all those testimonies. So you can actually listen to people telling their side of the story. And they don't always agree. Very clearly, they don't agree. But I was especially, you know, I sat up in my chair when I heard the journalist talking about April 19th and that it was the day that Waco happened, because it's like they pushed it. They said, okay, this is the day. We're bringing this thing to an end. So much so that the journalists and the onlookers and even the negotiators were shocked. They were surprised. It was like, well, why do we have to, you know, take these measures right now? We've waited this long because they had women and children in there, and they're trying to find a way to get the women and the kids out. And then suddenly, boom, the whole thing comes crashing to an end. And then they mention this date, April 19th. So that's what made me notice it. I'd never noticed it before. But the fact that they drew such attention to it, and then they said, well, this is the same day, April 19th, that the Oklahoma City bombing happened. And I have to tell you, even though I'm not an expert on all the events surrounding it, I've studied it on and off over the years. But from the people that I've talked to, and I know people who actually live out there in Oklahoma, I've never met anybody who does research into all of that kind of thing. I've never met anybody who actually believes the official narrative. Most everybody believes there's some kind of undercover government conspiracy going on. Now, the thing is about that, whereas 10 years ago, people might have dismissed suspicions about the CIA or federal agents doing things, having some kind of covert or hidden agenda. What should alarm all Americans now? For all those of you who are out there who said, oh, we just don't want to listen to these conspiracy theories or whatever. Okay, at this point, what you should do is you should pay attention to the fact that Robert Kennedy Jr., that people like Tucker Carlson, Robert Kennedy Jr., Megyn Kelly, and now Ron Paul, all are coming out and they're talking about the fact that from within the CIA, somehow or other, they are now admitting that the CIA was behind the assassination of John F. Kennedy. They're admitting it. And I've seen repeated mainstream people, people who, you know, 10 years ago, they would never have come out and said this kind of thing in public because they would have just been shouted down as conspiracy theorists and imbalance and that kind of thing. But now we're seeing more and more. We're seeing Tucker Carlson. We're seeing Megyn Kelly. We're seeing RFK Jr., a member of the Kennedy family, coming out and saying he fully believes that the CIA was behind the assassination of his uncle. And RFK believes that they killed not only his uncle, John F. Kennedy, but also his father, Robert Kennedy Sr. And then here just the other day, I saw a video clip of Ron Paul being interviewed, and he's talking about how, yes, there is a coup at work in Washington, D.C. against our country, and he believes that it all goes back to the assassination of John F. Kennedy. But I'm going to play the audio because I think this is very important to hear and to consider. But here it is, Ron Paul being interviewed, and he talks about the coup going on in Washington. Let's listen to what he says. Here it is.
Oh, there's been a coup. We don't have any resemblance to a government that believes in a republic. We don't have honest money. We don't have integrity. We don't even have people in Washington that even pretends, you know, that you're supposed to tell the truth. You know, remember just recently there was a congressperson that won, and he won by putting on his resume just a bunch of lies. And the other ones got hysterical. The other congressman is telling lies like this. And I got to thinking, well, how many of these people that were complaining about this guy telling lies, how many of them lied when they raised their hand up and swore to uphold the Constitution? Now, that's a lie that really has consequences. Actually, you could probably make fun and make a little joke, because his jokes weren't, everybody knew he was fibbing, but the real lies are being told, and that is our big problem. But I do believe there has been a coup, and it's been taken over, and if I want to just put the date in my mind, and anybody could pick probably any date in the last 100 years, but I have picked November 22nd, 1963.
What happened on that day?
That was the day Kennedy was murdered by our government.
Wow.
You know, by the CIA.
All right. So again, that was Ron Paul being interviewed, and he talks about when he believes the coup in Washington, D.C. actually began or took place. He goes back to the assassination of John F. Kennedy, where he believes our own government through the CIA was responsible for the killing of John F. Kennedy. That is an incredible admission. I remember all the years that anyone in mainstream media would go out of their way to support the lone gunman Lee Harvey Oswald argument. And now here it is, the whole thing is being turned around. Clips like that and the other clips of Tucker Carlson, Megyn Kelly, and RFK Jr., those are things that if you've got friends or family members who are always telling you that they don't want to have anything to do with so-called conspiracy theories, showing them this information, which you can find online readily right now, could be a way of waking them up and reminding them that the Bible itself warns us about conspiracies. In Ezekiel, where it says there is a conspiracy of prophets in the midst thereof. And many other passages. Psalm chapter 2 is describing the conspiracy of kings and rulers that take counsel together against the Lord and against his Christ. And that's what we're watching unfold. We're watching these globalist powers that are decidedly anti-Christ, trying to undermine the entire Christian world and the teaching of the gospel itself. Because that's really what ecumenism does. I did an earlier show on political ecumenism as the bane of Western civilization. But ultimately, ecumenism, that is trying to say that all religions are one and the same, is a complete betrayal of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And it must be rejected by every true Christian. All right. Now, there's a couple of more points that I want to make here in this final segment of our radio show. And one of them, I want to add something to what we were talking about earlier about the militia and the definition of militia, because sometimes you hear militia being mentioned as all the people, and then sometimes it's a select body of people. I think I said earlier, men 18 to 45 years old. Well, I found a quote that defines this, that articulates it in a very specific way, from Richard Henry Lee. Richard Henry Lee, who was an early revolutionary founder from that whole era of the Revolutionary War. Anyway, Lee said this. He said, quote, "The Constitution ought to secure a genuine militia and guard against a select militia." He says, quote, "All regulations tending to render this general militia useless and defenseless by establishing select corps of militia or distinct bodies of military men not having permanent interests and attachments to the community ought to be avoided. So Lee is actually warning against what we're hearing from people like David Hogg and others, what they're arguing. And I really find it fascinating that these arguments have been articulated in the past, centuries past, that Lee is saying, okay, there are people who think there should only be select militia, meaning government-controlled militia. And he's saying, no, we need a general militia. And the general militia is the people. Here's another quote. He says, Lee says, quote, "To preserve liberty, it is essential that the whole body of people always possess arms and be taught alike, especially when young, how to use them." Now, what he's describing there is the general militia, which he believed was the whole population of the people. That's what he would call the general militia. A select militia would be when you set apart a body of men who are called the militia, but they're under the control of some government body. Okay? So he makes a distinction between general militia and select militia. And he very clearly, I mean, if you read his writings, we don't have time to go over all of them, but there's a lot of dialogue from him on this, and he is resisting the idea that anyone would argue for select militia only, because that would diminish the right of the people and the freedom of the people and of society. That's what he's warning against. So he's specifically warning against arguments that we're hearing now from those on the left who are trying to argue against an individual's right to keep and bear arms. Very, very interesting history. I find all of it really fascinating. But what I want to do now is shift over and talk about the right to bear arms from a biblical perspective. From a biblical perspective, what does the Bible say? Well, let's remember Psalm chapter 144 and verse 1, a psalm of David. "Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teaches my hands to war and my fingers to fight." Blessed be the Lord, my strength, which teacheth my hands to war and my fingers to fight. Obviously, war is something that is at times commanded by God. There is a time for peace. There's a time for war. And men of war obviously must be armed. The Bible says the Lord is a man of war. Whenever the children of Israel were subjugated by their enemies, they were typically deprived of the right to bear arms. We read about this in 1 Samuel chapter 13 and verse 19, when the people of Israel were being subjugated by the Philistines. It says in verse 19, "Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears." So the Philistines, according to their arms regulations, would not allow the Jewish people, the Hebrews, to have a blacksmith. They couldn't have a blacksmith, lest they should make them swords or spears, make any weapons to defend themselves. So when King Saul and Jonathan go into the first war, the first battle against the Philistines, only Saul and Jonathan had swords. Everybody else had some kind of farm implement. And what had to happen, if you keep reading 1 Samuel chapter 13, the Israelites had to go down to the Philistines if they wanted to sharpen their farming tools. So you could only go to a Philistine blacksmith. And I think this is part of the reason why Blackstone, Sir William Blackstone, in his commentaries said, "Free men have arms, slaves do not." Whenever the people of God, ancient Israel, were subjugated by their enemies, they were denied the individual right to bear arms. We also find a similar situation in Judges, the book of Judges, chapter 5, in the Song of Deborah. When they fight the battle against Sisera, God grants them victory, and afterwards you have the Song of Deborah. She's giving glory to God, and she's talking about what happened in Israel. How did the Israelites become subjugated by their enemies, by Sisera and the kings of Canaan, King Jabin in particular? And what happened? She says in verse 8, they chose new gods. Then was war in the gates. Was there a shield or spear seen among 40,000 in Israel? And if you go read the commentaries on this, what she's saying is that there was a general disarming of the people of Israel, that they didn't even have a shield or a spear, one among 40,000 of their people. So she's really describing the scarcity of arms. They were subjugated. They did not have the ability to take up arms and fight and resist. Now, if you read the commentaries on this, some of the commentators think that it was because they were fearful to take up arms. Others argue that it may have been through neglect, that they just failed to keep up the use of arms, and that that was part of the reason why they were subjugated. That's another interesting argument. It is generally thought that part of the reason Poland during World War II fell so quickly to both the Nazis and the communists, Hitler invaded on one side, Stalin invaded on the other, part of the reason was said to be that Poland was so unprepared for war, that they were simply not ready for war. And then when their enemies came upon them, they fell very quickly into the hands of the Nazis and the communists. And there were millions of Polish people who suffered greatly. You all know who have followed our program that I've talked about my grandfather, Zygmunt Zatorowski, who we all called Ziggy. He was our adopted grandfather, but he was a World War II veteran, and he was from Poland originally. And he would tell stories about how quickly their country fell when the Nazis and the communists invaded. So there's the old saying, if you want peace, prepare for war. Now, we look in contrast to what we read in the Song of Deborah, contrast that with David. 1 Samuel chapter 25, verse 13. This is before David becomes king. He's actually on the run from King Saul. King Saul is persecuting him, and David he's taken to the field with his men. And you read in 1 Samuel 25, verse 13, it says, and David said unto his men, gird ye on every man his sword. And they girded on every man his sword. And David also girded on his sword. And there went up after David about 400 men, and 200 abode by the stuff. Okay? So notice, every man had his sword. Every man. There are similar passages about the days of King Solomon, how Solomon made none of the men of Israel bondmen, or slaves, if you will, but they were all men of war, that all the men were men of war in one way or another, and had their own sword, and had to be ready to use it. That is part of the reason why in the English-speaking world, this tradition and belief goes all the way back to Alfred the Great, possibly even earlier than King Alfred, but I know that it's traceable back to Alfred, because when the Danish Vikings invaded the Anglo-Saxon territories, many of the kingdoms fell quickly. Many of the territories were given over to these heathen invaders, and it's generally thought that it's because the Christian populations were completely unprepared to defend themselves. And so this would have been why Alfred eventually required that every man be armed and ready to go at a moment's notice to take up arms and to defend the realm once they got things back under control once Alfred was able to drive out many of these heathen forces from their lands. They had to be ready to protect themselves, their families, and their country. And I believe that that is ultimately where the Minuteman mentality came from in England and into America. The idea of being continually ready. That, and also, I think, from the Bible, from Nehemiah, where Nehemiah, when they were being threatened by their enemy, required that men work with one hand, and in the other hand, they had their sword. So they were ready to go at a moment's notice. And when their enemies saw that they were ready, they chose not to attack. Hence the saying, if you want peace, prepare for war. So all of these, there are biblical teachings concerning men-at-arms taking a stand, godly men, God-fearing men, taking a stand against evil. In our film, The True Christian History of America, we have an interview with Dr. Peter Hammond from South Africa, and he talks about the sixth commandment, which is thou shall not kill, and how in the Westminster Confession of Faith, there's two sides to that commandment, at least as they see it in the Westminster Confession. One side is obviously that you can't kill, you can't be guilty of the wrongful slaying of another person. That's one side. The other side is that as a Christian, we have a duty to prevent murders from happening. It's our duty, if we see that it looks like somebody is about to be killed wrongfully, it's our duty to intervene and try and put a stop to it. So that's the other side of thou shall not kill. It's a responsibility to prevent the crime from happening if it is at all within our power to do so. Now think about that in terms of living in a country like Nazi Germany, where you know that these evil powers are rounding people up and taking them off to concentration camps and killing millions of people. What responsibility would the Christians have had living in Germany at that time? Of course, we know the story of people like Corrie ten Boom. She and her family were rescuing Jews, trying to protect them. Then there were others. We know about the Operation Valkyrie, where some of the military men got organized and they tried to take Hitler out, tried to remove him from power by force. And today, those men are seen as heroes for what they attempted to do. And some people even think because Germany, after the war, was condemned by virtually everyone, not just the government, the people were condemned because the thinking was, how could you, the people, have allowed this to happen? But if you go and watch a documentary on, there's several, but one in particular about what those men did, they argue that Operation Valkyrie shone forth as like a light in the darkness of Nazi Germany. And it showed that the German people knew that what Hitler was doing was evil, it was wrong, and that, yes, they were willing to take a stand against it. They tried to take a stand against it. They tried to put a stop to it. But ultimately, for whatever reason, it was necessary that the Allied forces come in and remove the Nazi government. Very, very interesting. But there's a lot at work here, brothers and sisters. A lot at work. There's a lot behind the anniversary of the battles of Lexington and Concord. April 19th, 1775. That day is coming up. Very interesting times that we live in because the struggle over how to understand the Second Amendment and what it means and how it will be preserved in our country, that struggle goes on. So we can only hope and pray that our fellow Americans will take the time to educate themselves, to learn as much as possible, so that we won't fall into the trap that we've seen other countries fall into, and eventually they lose their liberty. They lose their freedom. In fact, you know, I made reference earlier to a letter. It's actually a pretty well-known letter from William H. Sumner to John Adams back in 1823. You can actually find it. I just looked it up. You can find it on Amazon. And the full title, it says, quote, "An Inquiry into the Importance of the Militia to a Free Commonwealth," in a letter from William H. Sumner to John Adams with his answer. That is the answer from Adams. And I read a quote from Adams earlier. One of the things that Sumner talks about is how the nations of Europe are nations that have standing armies, but then the greater population of people, he says, are unarmed peasantry. So that one pitched battle with an enemy could decide their fate. In other words, if their army is defeated, that's it. The people are basically sitting there waiting to be enslaved by whatever invader comes into their territory. But he says in America, this is not the case because the common people are armed. Even if our military force was defeated, the country itself is not defeated because the people, having arms, can keep up the fight. And in most any war, the common people will outnumber an invading enemy. And so they'll be able to take to the hills, to the trees, to the forests, etc., and they'll be able to keep up the fight and eventually overcome the invader. That was his whole argument. Now, I'm paraphrasing it. You'd have to go look it up to read the whole thing. But it's very clear from his description, which is really just one of many examples of how our founders did believe in that individual right to keep and bear arms. And it's a practice that went back to the early colonies and went back to England and really went back centuries earlier, all the way back to King Alfred. All right, brethren, that is going to do it for us today. That is our show. We'll stop it there. But we will be back next time as the Lord leads us. Until then, God bless you guys. I'm Chris Pinto, and you've been listening to Noise of Thunder Radio.